Welcome to the Getting Off Course podcast. I'm your host, Josh Waldron, and this is episode number 13. I'm joined today by John Mahaffey, a retired professional golfer and winner of 10 PGA Tour events, including the 1978 PGA Championship. John has worked for the Golf Channel and recently published a new book, which we'll talk about at the tail end of the podcast. John, thanks for joining me today.
Josh, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I'm excited about this episode. You know, you have a milestone here. You are the oldest guest I've ever had on the show.
Oh my God. Well, I'm probably the oldest on a lot of things in a lot of places. I've been around for a while.
So I'm sure this isn't the first time you've been asked to do this, but I want you to take a trip down memory lane. Are you up for that?
Absolutely.
Great. So the year is 1970. And you've just graduated from the University of Houston. At that point, did you know that you were going to become a professional golfer?
I was pretty sure of it, yeah. I had a great summer. I was tied for low amateur in the U.S. Open at Hazeltine with Ben Crenshaw. Played with Lee Trevino in my last round. I won the NCAA individual, and my team, University of Houston, had won the team championship, and that we were actually team championships back-to-back in 69 and 70. I went to work for Jackie Burke and Jimmy DeMerritt at Champions north of Houston. Both of them Hall of Fame players, major championship winners, obviously. And Jimmy DeMerritt was Ben Hogan's best friend. Mm. And Ben Hogan was, I learned how to play golf out of Ben Hogan's book. Grew up in a small town in Texas with not any formal teaching. So had a lot of pluses going my way. And fortunately, I think a lot of it happened because I did go to work for Jackie Burke and Jimmy DeMerritt at Champions.
Yeah, it's amazing how like one connection along the way can be really pivotal. And you may not know it at the time.
For sure. I mean, I've been so lucky my whole life, though. I've been lucky to be in the right place at the right time to meet the right people and have the right things happen at the right time in my career. So kind of blessed that way and thankful for it, yeah. Believe me.
So 1971, you turned pro. Did you have a sponsor or did you fund this journey? Like, how did this all work out?
I did have a sponsor, a member at Champions. Actually, I had a mentor at that point as well in Ben Hogan. When I was working for Jackie Burke and Jimmy DeMerritt at Champions, the other assistants realized that I was there not to try to learn how to sell golf balls or, you know, carts or whatever.
Sure.
18s or 9-hole deals. They knew I was there to try to get ready, and that they had two really world-class golf courses, and I could practice as much as I pretty much wanted to. I had other duties in the pro shop for a while, but everybody kind of knew what I was there for. And one of the guys that, I don't know whether he was envious, jealous, what the heck it was, but he used to kind of ride me a lot. So he called me one night, and he knew that I had learned how to play golf out of Ben Hogan's book, The Five Lessons, The Fundamentals of Golf. So he called me, he said, Mr. DeMerritt wanted to know if you would partner with him tomorrow and play a match against Jackie Burke and Ben Hogan. Well, I'm thinking the guy's pulling my leg. I'm saying, no way, this is happening, you know. I had no idea Hogan was coming into town, Mr. Hogan. And he was coming in for a tournament called the Houston International at the time at Champions. He always came into tournaments early to get prepared. He didn't want to leave anything undone before he went to the sure. to the first tee the first day. So it turned out to be true. I went and I played I went over to the golf course at 9 o'clock, and we were scheduled to tee off at 10. And here they were, Ben Hogan, Jimmy DeMerritt, and Jackie Burke hitting practice balls over on the right side of the practice tee. And I immediately went to the left side and scared to death.
Sure.
Because here's the guy that's, you know, the guy I learned how to play golf from, a guy that I idolized, and, you know, probably one of the best players ever, had more control over the golf ball than anybody I've ever played with.
Yeah.
You know, just a special kind of guy. So anyway, Jackie Burke being the Marine that he is, he gives me kind of a wave like this, come on over. And time to tee off. So I go to the first tee, and I meet Ben Hogan for the first time. And, I mean, he's just like what you would imagine. He's got the slacks that are with the crisp crease in it, and the light blue shirt and the Ben Hogan hat. and his hands are huge and they're calloused, you know, the whole deal, and tanned and all this. And anyway, we start the match. Mr. DeMeritt's my partner. And that time of year in Houston, it's April.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of thunderstorms coming through there. So we only get to play nine holes that day. And it, I mean, it's lightning and everything else. Well, we go inside and we go into the locker room. And I shot 5 under 31 on my own ball.
Yeah.
And Hogan shot 34.
Wow.
Okay. We're playing for money that I don't have.
Right.
But, you know, one of the members was kind enough to kind of to back me on this kind of deal, right? So we go in the locker room and I'm sitting up by the bar, and Mr. DeMeritt's locker's by the bar, and which is only fitting. He'd like to have a nip or two from time to time. And so the three of them kind of crowded down in a little huddle and started talking. And then they look up and look at me, and Cleve, the locker room attendant and bartender, he goes, "Hey, what's going on? What'd you do?" And I said, "I don't know what I did." He said, "What'd you shoot?" I said, 31. 31? He said, "What did Hogan shoot?" I said, 34. He said, "Oh boy. You know, some, what did I do wrong?" You know,
right. Kind of deal. Just playing well, my
anyway,
game, right?
There. Yeah. And, I mean, I was so excited to play with the guy in the first place. And then to play well was, you know, really a bonus. And so a few minutes later, Mr. Hogan stands up. He walks over to the bar and he said, "Young man, do you want to play golf tomorrow?" And I looked over at Burke and DeMeritt because I'm working for them. And they go, you know, nod yes. So we make a game for the same time the next day. Well, that night we have what we call a norther come through. That the wind was blowing and it rained about a foot.
Wow.
You know, and the golf course was the longest on the tour anyway. And so we played all the way back. I ended up shooting 70 and Hogan shot 69.
Wow.
We go back in the locker room and same situation. I'm up at the bar talking to Cleve and these guys are huddled up. Now Mr. Hogan walks over and he goes, "John," now he knows my name, which is kind of scary.
Yeah.
You know? Are you gonna have dinner at the club tonight, right? Well, normally at that period in time, assistants didn't really eat at the club. And one of the members happened to overhear it. And said, "Yes, he's having dinner with us tonight." Hogan said, "Fine, be there at 7. So at 7 o'clock, he walks over to, I'm not having dinner with Hogan, I'm having dinner with the members. And he walks over to where I'm sitting. He says, "John, how would you like to play in Colonial in Fort Worth next week?"
Wow.
As a champion's invite. And I said, "Mr. Hogan, I'd love to, but I'm not a member of the tour." I didn't ask you if you were a member of the tour.
Oh, man.
I asked you if you wanted to play in Colonial next week. You know, and I said, "Yes, sir, I'd love to." So he walks into Merritt and Burke's office, makes a call, comes back. He says, "All right, you're in." He says, "But there's a stipulation for sure." He says, "You have to play your practice rounds with me and me only." Well, let me see. I learned how to play golf out of Hogan's book. He's my hero. He's won at Colonial 5 times. They call it Hogan's Alley, right? And he's going to teach me how to play Colonial. Well, heck yes. I'm loving this. So
yeah, that's incredible.
I know. So I go, "You want me to continue with this? Because I think it's a neat story."
No, I love okay? it. Keep going.
Okay. So we play the practice rounds and he does. He teaches me how to hit shots, but the type of shots to play into certain holes.
Mm-hmm.
Like the third hole, for instance, we get up and we both drive it about the same place. It's a big dog leg left. And so I pull out a 2-iron. It's dead into the wind. So I'm going to. And he shakes his head no. And I'm thinking, well, I can get a 2-iron there. I know I can get a 2-iron there. So I just blister this thing. Hits the front of the green, takes one hop, and goes over the green. He walks over to my bag, picks out a 4-wood, hands it to me. He says, "Now hit me a little cut in there." So I hit a little cut, lands on the front of the green, takes about 3 hops, and stops up about 6 feet from the hole. He said, "This green is always harder than most of the other greens because it's exposed out in the wind and all that kind of stuff." So, I mean, you know, stuff like that, golf course management is what he taught me to do. So I play all the practice rounds, and I never see him after that. Not one time, never in the gallery, anything. So I finished the tournament. Well, I get to the last 9 holes of the tournament, make the cut, and I've got a chance to win the golf tournament with 9 holes to go.
Not to interrupt here, but how old are you at this point?
22.
Okay.
All right, just graduated from college, pretty much. Oh, we're playing the last 9 holes. I've got a chance to win. And so I absolutely blow it. I choked my guts out. I really did. And I ended up tying for 12th. Gene Littler won. This was 1971. And, you know, I go back to my Holiday Inn and I'm depressed. I am just sitting there shaking my head and packing up my stuff. And I'm going to drive back down the Interstate 45 to Houston, dejected. I've let my hero down, you know,
right.
I'm feeling like. And And so the phone rings in my room, and he said, and it's Mr. Hogan. He says, well, he said, we didn't do too well on that back nine. I said, no, sir, I didn't. He says, well, he says, you need a lot more practice. You're playing at a different level mm-hmm. than you've ever been used to, you know?
Yeah.
And because when I played well in the U.S. Open in 70, I was an amateur, so there really wasn't that much pressure. It wasn't a livelihood.
Right.
And so anyway, he says, do you know where the Hogan factory is? I said, no, sir, I don't. He says, it's on West Pafford. Find it. Be there at 10 in the morning. So I'm there at exactly, you know, a little bit before 10 and exactly 10 o'clock. His secretary, Clarabel is her name. And she opens the door to Mr. Hogan's office. I walk in, and he's sitting at a desk way up here, and I'm sitting in a chair way down here. He's in the power position.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And he smoked a lot. So he takes out a cigarette and he lights it and he smokes an entire cigarette looking at it. And I'm getting smaller and shrinking down in this chair like that. So he opens his desks, he puts out the cigarette, opens his desk and pulls out two sheets of paper and hands me one. And he said, this is a contract. I want you to represent the Ben Hogan Company on the PGA Tour. Wow. I've never asked anybody to do it. This is the first person I want to do this. I said, but Mr. Hogan, I know you're not a member of the tour. I've already made a call up to Canada, the Peter Jackson Tour. You're going to start in 3 weeks. You're going to start a tournament in Winnipeg and you're going to play west all the way over to Vancouver.
Wow.
Seven golf tournaments. All right. My club maker, you'll read through the contract. The guy that makes my clubs is going to make your clubs. Don't think you're ever going to get out of this factory without me seeing the clubs you're going out with, because I have to approve them. You know, you're going to wear the clothing, the hat, play the ball, the whole deal. So he said, I want you to take the contract back and have your people look at it. So that we did, and I signed up with the Hogan Company, and that started a almost 20-year relationship with him being my mentor.
Wow. That's incredible. What a great story.
Oh, I've never been more honored in my life, honestly. Yeah.
Very cool. Thanks for sharing.
You bet.
So let's jump into your PGA career here. What are some lessons that you learned in those first few years of competition?
Well, first of all, I qualified for the tour and I qualified for the first tournament as first alternate. I went out to LA to play the first tournament, and we were actually, the field was pretty full. You'd have to kind of get in if somebody withdrew.
Yeah.
And so I remember playing El Caballero, and there was a six-way playoff for first alternate, and I won that.
Wow.
So I got in, and unfortunately for Lanny Watkins, he had a family emergency, and he had to withdraw. So I played, in his spot, and was tied for the lead after the first round. Made the cut and that kind of stuff. Didn't fare all that well after that, but what I kept doing is I kept making cuts and so forth. At that time, the top 60 were the ones exempt for the next year.
Okay.
And that was basically my goal. Of course, I wanted to win, but I also wanted to get my card so that I wouldn't have to worry about going back to qualify.
Sure.
Or Monday qualifying. So I ended up playing like 22 tournaments in a row. All right. Because I kept making the cuts. I didn't want to go back to Monday qualifying. I couldn't depend on a sponsor's exemption because they were handed out to a select few of the guys that had a really great amateur career that had made it. So I remember I finished second alone in Memphis, that 22nd tournament. And that got me in the top 60 for sure.
Yeah.
So I took the next week off, and then I asked for an exemption the week after that and didn't get it. And I thought, that's not very smart, because that particular tournament, I had a tendency to skip more often than I played just because of that. You know, that kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. But I made the top 60 that year, but didn't win a tournament. I had a third place in Boston and a bunch of top 10s, top 20s, but didn't win, but got close enough.
Mm-hmm.
Then I won my first tournament in 73 at the end of the year in Las Vegas that got me into the Masters the next year and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And to a different level. And I think the whole thing that happened in the tour is back then you got through different choking levels of trying to qualify. You qualify to get in. You tried to make the top. You tried to make the cut.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you made the top 25, you were in that tournament for the next year too. All these kind of things. Then you tried to get in top tens. Then you tried to win.
Yeah.
So each level, you know, and I think it made you a better player because you realized you didn't want to go back to those other levels.
Right.
Yeah. And the first win was always the sweetest.
Yeah, so this is 1973. You referenced it, the Sahara Invitational.
Right.
You shot 13 under for the win.
Right.
Describe that feeling.
Well, it was totally incredible. And the thing was that I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to look. I didn't know if I should check leaderboards or whatever. I was playing right behind David Eichelberger, who had the lead. No, Dave got the lead at the, going into the last holes. That's what it was. I was playing right behind him, and he played very well on the front nine and had the lead. And then he kind of had a couple of instances, a couple of bogeys, maybe a double, and then he got to the 18th hole. And I had a two-shot lead. All I really had to do was make par. It's par five, and I had a really good drive down there, and I contemplated going for the green and two, but they had water. I laid up, knocked it on, and three, and made my par to win by two. So, and the greatest thing about it was Wonder Woman was the one that presented the prize. it was a big wheelbarrow full of silver dollars, Vegas.
Yeah.
You know, it would have to be that way. And Del Webb was the guy with her, and she was Miss Las Vegas. So, you know, that was sort of a thrill in itself.
Oh, yeah. So I looked up, first prize for that event was $27,000.
Right.
And I ran that number through an inflation calculator.
Okay.
Do you have any idea about how much that would be today?
A million what? I don't know.
Not quite that big, but big enough. $172,000.
Oh, okay.
So do you remember like what you did with that money from your first win?
Well, it kind of secured me with, I played from then on my own money pretty much, which was great.
Yeah.
I really don't. I don't think I went and bought a car or anything special. My wife and I went out and had Mexican food and had a nice celebration. That was about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's smart to not always just spend, right? So you were obviously a wise young man. You didn't go all blow it right away.
My dad taught me a lot of stuff. I learned a whole lot. I mean, he was my hero from day one.
Yeah.
He always had a lot of faith in me and stuff. And I learned a lot, his work ethic, his integrity, and tried to exemplify that. He was a great role model.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to go out and splurge anything. I saw too many guys that were like one and done. They'd win a golf tournament and buy a new house, a couple of new cars and stuff like that. Then how do they pay for it?
Yeah.
You know, they don't do anything after that. So, you know, it's not never a sure thing. You're one injury away from not being able to play, and you're, who knows, you know?
Yeah, I credit my dad for my work ethic, and having someone in your life who teaches you how to work or how to manage money, really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you get your first PGA Tour victory 2 years into your career, but then there's this gap of 4 years where I know you're competitive in those years, but you don't get a win. What's going through your mind during that time? Are you optimistic? Are you discouraged? Like, put us in your shoes for a minute.
Well, I came so close so many times. That's what I had a lot of seconds, a lot of thirds, a lot of top tens. I had in 1975, I was tied. Lou Gramm and I tied after 72 holes for the U.S. Open. I lost a playoff on Monday at Medina in Chicago, and I hit 16 greens in the U.S. Open playoff. I didn't make a single putt all day, you know. And he had a great day on the greens, and you know, it's just that that one day deal can get anybody, but. And then the following year, I had a chance to win in Atlanta, and Jerry Pate beat me in the last three holes. I had a couple of bad bounces, which happened in U.S. Opens. It happens every time. I'm not blaming it on that.
Yeah.
But, you know, an unfortunate situation. But I had an opportunity to be a back-to-back U.S. Open winner, and it didn't happen. And it was a little discouraging. But I kept after it, and I kept working. Mr. Hogan was encouraging. You know, the fact that I was that close, that I actually tied for a U.S. Open, you know, and a lot of times it's your 30s back in the day were really the times that you played your best. 30s into your 40s was the time that most players really played well, and with the exception of Nicklaus, who played well for forever.
Sure.
You know, guys like that. But I was still optimistic.
I wanted to take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Chasing Aces. If you're anything like me, the pursuit of the ever-elusive ace is one of the reasons to keep stepping onto the course. I'm not going to lie, my ace count is currently zero, so there has never been a more appropriate sponsor for me to partner with. Chasing Aces offers a stylish lineup of t-shirts, polos, and hats, so all of us can look fresh as we pursue that hole-in-one. This isn't your predictable, boring, everyday golf gear. Chasing Aces will keep you looking sharp from the clubhouse to the tee box. I want you to add some Chasing Aces gear to your lineup, so I'm launching a small contest to go with this ad. Purchase any Chasing Aces apparel item, and you'll be entered to win one of their accessory items as a bonus. All you need to do is send an email of your receipt to gettingoffcourse@gmail.com, and you'll be automatically entered to win. The drawing will take place on June 1st. Will Chasing Aces gear be the extra luck factor that pushes you over the edge? There's only one way to find out. Visit chasingacesgolf.com to browse their lineup. You can also find them on Instagram at chasingacesgolf. All right, back to the show. Yeah, so you come close to winning a couple times. 1978 ends up being the big year where you pull off this incredible comeback victory to win the PGA Championship. What's the moment that stands out in your mind from that day?
I think the 10th hole at Oakmont. It's a long, tough par four. It's straight away, but it's straight downhill for the second shot, and the green goes away from you. And Tom Watson was pretty much in control. And I think I played a really good front nine, a couple under maybe. And then I get to 10, and I hit it on the front left of the green. And Watson is having all kinds of struggles on this hole, ends up making double bogey. And I'm on the front. I've got about a 60-foot putt with about a 60-foot break in it. I start it way up on the right side of the green. It's curling around, and it comes back down, and I make it. So that's a three-shot swing. Then I birdie the next hole. All right, now I've made up four shots. Now I'm in a hunt. And, you know, and I'm thinking, all right, now we've been here before. We had two chances to win U.S. Open. It didn't happen. You're playing great, you know, and I had one miscue. I three-putted the 16th hole. I misjudged the first putt from long distance and left it short. I thought it would be quicker and missed the putt coming in. But I had a shot 66 the last round. Not a Johnny Miller round, but good enough to get a tie. And Jerry Pate kind of helped me out on the last hole, and Watson. And he had about a three-footer from behind the hole and did a 360 and stayed out. You know, sometimes the golf gods are kind to you.
Sure.
You know, the bad bounces I got in Atlanta, maybe they evened out at Oakmont.
Yeah. Yeah, you never know when the scale's going to be tipped in your favor or against you. You just got to go with it.
Right.
So I don't want to gloss over the rest of your career. You had a great run competing all the way into the early 2000s. Why do you think you were so successful?
I think work ethic. I think the fact that people like Ben Hogan, and I learned a lot of good, I learned the fundamentals. I always had a very good grip. I was a very good iron player. I led the tour in 1985 and 86 in greens and regulation. So I put the ball in the fairway a lot. I hit a lot of greens.
Yep.
I was an adequate putter, never a Crenshaw or a Nicklaus or a Watson, but I made my share. I didn't three putt a lot. So I was always kind of there. And I think that evidenced by some of the wins that I had coming from behind when guys faltered, I was kind of there to take over.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a lot easier to come from behind than it is to hold a lead a lot of times. I never led enough.
Sure.
I really know how that felt. I had one tournament, and Andy North shot 29 at me at Kingsmill one year, and I had to really hustle because I looked up at the leaderboard. Oh my God, what did he do? You know, now I've got to play well to finish, and ended up getting that done. But most of my wins were either in playoffs or come from behind him.
So you eventually went on to work for the Golf Channel. How did you know it was time to walk away from professional competition?
Well, something that I had absolutely no control over. I was a premature baby, not expected to live. Spent 2 months in an incubator and this, and I was always small. People always told me I couldn't do this. I had polio when I was 4 years old.
Wow.
So I wasn't supposed to live. After polio, I was never supposed to be able to play any athletics. And I lettered in every sport I played in and actually had a basketball scholarship offer to play in junior college, as well as a golf scholarship offer to go to Houston. So obviously I'm going to take the Houston deal. But I overcame a lot because I had the injury. My hips never got fully developed. Because I had I was born prematurely. So I was playing on borrowed time. And all the way through my career, even at the end of my Champions Tour career, before I took before I went with the Golf Channel, I could barely walk the 18 holes. And I was trying not to finish last. And Keith Hirschland, who was at that time one of the producers for the Golf Channel for the Champions Tour, he says, why don't you try out for the Golf Channel? I know I can still play. Well, my wife got tired of hearing that, and we got tired of finishing last. So she looked at me. She says, okay, look, I talked to Keith the other day, and I said, oh, come on. She said, no. I said, why in the world do you want me to get into television? She said, well, there's several reasons. One, you know the golf courses, you know the players, you know the game. You're not afraid to step out there and say something. She said, what's wrong with that? I said, well, probably nothing. She said, why don't you give it a chance? You're not going to play it. You're never going to come back. You've got, I mean, your hips are so bad. And a couple of years later, I had a bilateral hip replacement just so I could walk.
Wow.
Not to play golf.
Wow.
So the Golf Channel gave me an opportunity, and I was with them for 15 years, and I loved every minute of it. I really did. I made some great friends, great producers. They taught me how to do stuff. I had some great analysts to work with. Lanny was one of them. You know, play-by-play guys were awesome.
Yeah.
I learned a lot. It was fun. But I traveled pretty much since I was in college, playing golf and all over the place. And I'd written a book during that period of time with the Golf Channel called Hogan's Boy, The Journey in Golf. And basically because I wanted to tell some of these stories about Ben Hogan and the guys on the tour like Trevino and Burke and Demerit that helped me along the way, and so many more, you know, anecdotes and autobiographical things about stuff. So, and I wrote the book to give a little history and some of the stuff that I was so pleased to have played in, through three eras with Hogan, Nelson, and Snead all the way up to Tiger and Phil.
Yeah.
And being the greatest fraternity in the world.
Yeah.
Okay. And a major championship winner and all that kind of stuff. But it got to the point where I really wanted to do something else. And all the time that I traveled, even when I used to drive, I'd read mystery novels and different things like that. And I really got intrigued about doing this. And living in a fishbowl for your entire life where everybody sees stuff and you're like a traveling circus, you know. And everybody knows everybody, you know, all the families, you know, all this, you see this happening over here, this happening over there, all these different scenarios start forming in my head. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to call it Shafted, because there's so many different connotations to Shafted. Of course, it's related to golf.
Yeah.
But there's a whole lot of other things that happen in there. You know, you get a bitter part of life that you get shafted in, and all kinds of different things. So I had a ball writing that. And I decided after I wrote the first one, okay, and it was during this time when all the COVID stuff was happening, and I was retired. I wasn't probably going to leave the house anyway that much.
Right.
So I wrote three other books. And now I'm on the fourth one, meaning five books in what I call the Nemesis series.
Yeah.
So I'm having a ball doing this. It's a lot of fun for me. It's escapism, yes. Is it based on my personal experiences? Some. But it's also all the different things, all the things that you can put together.
Yeah.
It's fun to do that.
So this book, it's a thriller, right? Or a mystery. How would you classify it?
Mystery thriller.
Okay.
Mystery thriller.
So once upon a time, I wrote a 100-page nonfiction book, and it was a ton of work. Your first book in this series is nearly 300 pages long. Like, any estimate on how much time it took you to write this first book?
6 years.
Wow.
And the only reason it took 6 years is because when you write a nonfiction book like I did, Hogan's Boy, where it's historical and stuff like that, you use passive voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very easy to do. That's recollections. All you got to make sure is the chronology's right and all that kind of stuff, you know, different things like that. When you start writing fiction, now all of a sudden you're an active voice. And now you've got to make these people do things, all right? And I had some help along the way. I had some really great editors. I had a guy that I met on a trip to Normandy that was a writer in Hollywood that read part of the beginning of Shafted, all right? In its rawest sense. You know, he says, let me tell you something. He says, you need to keep doing this. He says, you got the soul of a writer. And when you have kind of encouragement like that, and I went through it, and to learn to write in active voice took a while.
Yeah, I
and
believe
I'm still
that.
Not really that good at it.
Yeah.
You know, thank goodness for editors.
Yeah.
they help a lot. But I think I've always been fortunate enough to be able to be a good storyteller. And I majored in psychology in college and minored in English.
Okay.
So I had a bit of a background where I could do this. And it turned out to be something. And in fact, this one guy that out from out in Hollywood, I said, okay, so Bill, if sometime I come up and I have the, what they call this writer's block thing, what do I do? He says, well, you probably won't have it. He says, you're a good storyteller. You can figure something out. But if you do, he says, take a day off. Your characters will tell you where to go. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is BS, man.
Right.
This can't be right.
Seems too
this
easy,
is Hollywood.
Right?
Guess what? He was right.
Wow.
And these people become your family. I mean, the McCall family, my thing is generational with this Nemesis thing. And the chairman or chairwoman of the thing, is I'm giving some stuff away. I shouldn't. But anyway, it goes up through the family. And they're a very proud family. They're a very, very tough family that take on adversity and defeat it. And it's there's a lot of karma involved, and I love it. It's fun to write. It's easy to, I think after this Nemesis series is done, I think I'm going to splinter it off and do something else with some of the other characters. Because, I mean, I've got to kill these people off somehow. They don't live forever.
That's what everyone's waiting for,
and I don't like
for,
to
right?
do it. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is great. So who's the target audience for your book? Like, who do you have in mind?
I think I'm going to get some golf people involved, first of all, because there is golf in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's some stories in it. Also, Mr. Hogan was kind enough to share some things with me that, and he maybe promised not to give them away. All right? And a promise made is a promise kept. I will not give them away. But in these books, there's hints to make people better players.
Yeah.
All right. And this, I mean, and it has to do with Trey McCall's the hero of the book, if you want to call him that. And, the protagonist, and he's the guy that, learns how to play golf. He gets in all kinds of trouble because he's too naive. He's grown up on a ranch, and he doesn't understand big city life, big city stuff. Nightlife gets in the way and he screws up. And he almost cost his family a whole bunch of stuff. And they all group together. And from then on, it's like, here we go.
Yeah.
And good things start happening to them. Bad things start happening to other people. And they're neat stories to interweave all these different characters in these different scenarios and make them come out at the end. Actually, I wrote the end of this book before I got to it. I kind of knew where I wanted to go. And then I made everything go to that direction.
Well, it sounds like quite the undertaking. And you referenced this idea, like writing a nonfiction piece is in comparison pretty easy. But part of the reason why I wanted to interview you was because I know it has to be difficult to write characters and piece all of this stuff together. And you're not just doing that for one book, you're doing this whole Nemesis series.
Mm-hmm.
So keep up the good work. Sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. I'm having an absolute blast doing this. I mean, you know, I think the thing is that once you start retiring from things, I like to reinvent myself, first of all. It's a lot of fun. It's new challenges,
mm-hmm.
totally different things. And I have learned so much from so many people. I'm so thankful for it and everything I've done. But I think you need to be open for that. I think you need to be open to the doors that are open to you and not be afraid to do it. You need to be a little bit scared.
Yeah.
That way you pay attention.
Yeah.
And I think it makes you better.
So I know the first book, Shafted, is available on Amazon. Is that where you'd prefer people go to get it, or where should they get it from?
Yeah, Amazon.com, and just type in John Mahaffey, and it'll take you to Hogan's Boy and to Shafted, and hopefully to Unfinished Business, which is at the editors right now.
Very cool.
It'll take a while. It takes a while.
I believe it, yeah. Do you have any target date for that release?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. I do. I think my editor sent something back. She's a sweetheart. I got an old lady team. I love this. You know, But she sent back, this is so much easier than your first book, because she taught me so much about the first book. I didn't know about taking breaks or anything like this. You know, I let chapters be breaks. Well, you don't want the reader to just keep reading on and on and on and on. You need a break to give them something to, you know, when you have a break in the action, all of a sudden this guy's doing a sift. All of a sudden now you're over in San Francisco from, Canada,
yeah,
from Montreal. And they go, well, how come that happened? Well, you need a break to make that happen. Anyway, I've learned a lot.
That's great. So, John, thanks for your time. I end every episode of the podcast with a lightning round.
Oh, boy.
So, quick questions, your first response. You ready for this?
Yeah, I'm going. I'm ready.
All right.
Let's do it.
So, other than your own, of course, what's your favorite book?
Atlas Shrugged.
All right. Give me one place I need to visit if I'm ever in Houston.
Champions.
That's where you got your start, right?
Champions Golf Club, yeah. Yes.
Who was the most underrated golfer from your era?
Larry Nelson.
And why do you think he was underrated?
He was never given the attention he should. He's a major championship winner, a multi-major championship winner, overlooked way too long to be a Ryder Cup captain or to be in the Hall of Fame. He still hadn't been a Ryder Cup captain, to my knowledge, to be in the Hall of Fame, and he deserved to be there. He was a Vietnam veteran and learned how to play golf when he came back from Vietnam, out of Hogan's book, by the way. And that's not the reason. He's also a good friend, but I admire what he's done, the skill that he had, and to be able to do it that quickly.
Yeah.
And successfully.
Question four. Who is your favorite golfer from this current era?
Wow. There's so many of them. Oh, Tiger. for a lot of different reasons. The obstacles, being as close to Ben Hogan as I was, and the accident that he went through, and all the perils that the Tiger has gone through and survived and come out and gotten ahead again. And, you know, there's rumors now that he may even go be playing Augusta here in a couple of weeks. So, you know, I admire the guy. He's got, he's one in a million.
Yeah.
Or maybe a zillion. Yeah.
All right. Final lightning round question for you. So word on the street, I saw this somewhere, is that you enjoy fishing. And since you're a good storyteller, I was wondering if you had a good fishing story to close things out.
I do. Tom Watson and I were best friends forever on the tour. All right. We used to go hunting. He came down to Kerrville, Texas, where I grew up, and he brought his dad and his brother-in-law at the time. And we went dove hunting. And so it was to reciprocate, he and his father took me up to Canada, up north of Winnipeg, flew in by a float plane, stayed in these cabins. So we're going to go fishing for Northern Pike and, what are the other ones? Can't think of it. Anyway, so they've been going up there since he was a little kid, all right? And none of them ever caught a trophy fish. So we're out the second day, and we've got these Indian guides in these canoes that we're going out. And we're going out at daybreak, and have a shore lunch and stuff. Walleye is the other one.
Yeah.
And we have walleye for lunch with potatoes and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the third day we're out, can't be more than about 15 minutes. So we're trolling around over these little rapids and stuff. And all of a sudden, this northern hits my line and it starts tail walking. This thing's huge. And this Indian guide, that's all he said the whole time was, ugh. Pretty much, you know, he goes, all right, now take it easy. Now hold it. No, let it go. Let him go. Come on. All right. Now get him. Now pull him in. Anyway, I land this thing and we drag him around all day and stuff like that. The very same day, we're jigging for walleye and bam, I get another trophy fish. Okay. So we're finishing. We finish and we go and we got this. The walleye is down here, and we got the other fish, the northern, strung up, and it's 43 and a half inches, the length of a driver.
Wow.
That we used to use. And so Tom Watson, we drug this thing around for all day long. You think it's probably dead, you know, or at least numb. And he sticks his finger in this thing's mouth.
Oh, they got those teeth.
Just in time, this thing goes like that, you know. But it didn't get him.
Oh,
it
man.
Didn't get him. But you know what? They never invited me back. Josh, they never invited me back to go fish.
Hey,
I can't imagine why.
You made your mark.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, John, this has been great. Thanks for joining me today. Is there anything you'd like to plug before we wrap up?
Well, I think you've done it for me, and I do appreciate it. Hogan's Boy, A Journey in Golf, is also a very good read. If you like a little of the history of the game and how life was back then. Now everybody's got their team, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it's a lot more individual. Yeah, they got friends and take vacations and stuff, but they have their team. Back then, we didn't.
Yeah.
And people like Mr. Hogan, like Lee Trevino, Chichi Rodriguez, Gary Player. I mean, a lot of guys, they'd help you out. If they knew that you had a work ethic and you weren't just going to, you know, not dedicate the time to get it right, they would teach you. They would help you.
Yeah.
I think that was their way of growing the game and prolonging the PGA Tour. And they did a great job of it because look where we are now with the PGA Tour. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, very cool. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out gettingoffcourse.com to see the show notes or listen to past episodes. I'll put a link to John's book there as well. You can also send me an email at gettingoffcourse@gmail.com. If you have time, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Getting Off Course is presented by Par 3 Near Me. Visit par3nearme.com to find a Par 3 or executive golf course near you.